Let's call tonight's meeting of the Planning and Zoning Commission to order. Can we get a roll call, please?
Steele.
Here.
Gable.
Here.
Mintz.
Here.
Sherwood.
Here.
McBride.
Here.
Smith.
Here.
Perkins.
Here.
Are there any changes or additions to tonight's agenda? Hearing none, the agenda will stand approved. Are there any changes or additions to the minutes from the 11th of July? The draft minutes should be in frame. Hearing none, the minutes will stand approved. We do have time for public comment right now. This is a time when you can address the Planning Commission about any issues that are not already scheduled to be heard tonight. Is there any comment from the public? Okay, thank you. So we'll move on to public hearings. CUP 08-18, City of Gilbert Wastewater Treatment Plant. Amelia.
Okay, so this is a request for a conditional use permit to permit improvements to the existing wastewater treatment plant. It is located just southwest of Gilbert in Section 9 of Franklin Township. The applicant is Fox Engineering and Woodruff Construction. Matthew with Fox Engineering is here tonight as well. So this is the vicinity map. You can see Gilbert is up here. Here's George Washington Carver, from which the wastewater treatment plant takes access. And then it actually extends up to the southwestern boundary of Gilbert. I have a zoomed-in photo to show you that. But the proposed site is a 36.65 net acre parcel. It is landlocked, but the city does own an adjacent parcel that provides access to George Washington Carver. The property is just southwest and adjacent to the city of Gilbert's corporate boundary. There is a railroad there, though, in between the corporate boundary and the property. And drainage ditch 70, which is also known as Gilbert Creek. I know Linda is familiar with that one.
I never knew either of the names until a month ago.
Runs on the south side of the property, and that's the receiving stream for the wastewater plant's discharge. This property, you'll see, was rezoned to commercial light industrial in 1969. Before we had the conditional use permit process, this was a principal permitted use in the commercial light industrial district. When the plant was updated in 1984 to add two additional lagoons, a conditional use permit was required. So the first two lagoons were permitted just as the principal permitted uses in the commercial zoning district. And then the second two lagoons were permitted through the conditional use permit process. So you can see this is the subject property. It's darker than the rest of the area because it's zoned commercial. But the rest of the area around it is zoned A1 agricultural and in agricultural production. Here is the railroad line adjacent to the city of Gilbert's boundary. The closest dwellings are located within the city of Gilbert. That is about 400 feet from the first cell in the lagoon. But these were recently constructed. I think maybe the closest one was constructed in 2015. This is the Ames Urban Fringe Plan map for the area. You can see that the area is designated as a natural area in the Ames Urban Fringe Plan. This is because of Gilbert Creek and there's floodplain. The rest of the surrounding area is designated as planned industrial area. So this is an area within the urban expansion designation where development should be encouraged to be annexed into the city and comply with city standards to make sure that appropriate infrastructure for this type of development is provided. Here's a floodplain map. You can see Gilbert Creek's floodplain as it runs to the southwest of the lagoons. And then here is the existing site. So you can see that there are four cells. Again, these two were permitted in 1969 through a rezoning process, and these two were permitted through a conditional use permit later. So this current request is a request to make improvements to the entire site. So it is a major modification to the conditional use permit to include the entire site in that conditional use permit. The current proposed improvements will change the type of the system used, but it will be within the existing footprint. So it will not be expanding the wastewater treatment plant, just changing how it functions. The current system is considered a controlled discharge lagoon system where wastewater is held for a certain number of days before it's discharged. And so this system hinders the capacity of the wastewater treatment system currently, which can be an issue if there's higher rainfalls or, you know, with the city's projected future growth. So the new system will operate as an aerated lagoon system and will also have submerged attached growth reactors and an ultraviolet light disinfection. And this will allow continuous discharge, which will address those capacity issues and also be able to better meet the NPDES permits through the Iowa DNR for E. coli levels. So site improvements to install this new system will include one new building that's above grade. It's a blower building that will hold the blowers that provide the aeration to the lagoons. It will be 32 feet by 26 feet and look like a utility building. It will be metal. I've got some photos here, or some drawings of the design. It will be 11 feet in height. And the blowers, again, will be inside the building, and they will be enclosed in kind of soundproof area to prevent excessive noise as well. This building will have an air inlet filter on the outside that will take air in to the blowers, and it will require a new transformer and generator as well. So this is the site plan for the blower building. Again, it will be in the northwest corner of the site. Some more gravel will be placed around the building. You can see here's the inlet on the north side that takes air into the building, into these blowers, which then connect into the lagoons. So here is the generator and the transformer as well that will be required. And this is the design. Here are the elevation drawings. So incoming wastewater will pass through a new an influent metering structure as well into the south. This new structure will be located below grade, however, and it will have a hatch cover over it for access. Additionally, sludge will be removed from cells 1 and 2, and the cells will be regraded. This sludge will be moved to cell number 4, which is the southwesternmost cell. Before it is goes through final disposal through land application. They will also be removing some clay for cell 1 to be used in the construction process, and that will be stored north of cell 3. I have a site plan to show you where that's at as well. And the east half of cell 3 will actually be converted into this stagger system. There will also be a new control structure to route the effluent from cell 1 to cell 2, and a new effluent structure to route the effluent to the stagger splitter structures. These will also be located below grade and have aluminum hatches over the top. The stagger cells consist of insulated and aerated below grade gravel beds that wastewater flows through, and the UV structure will actually be located next to and in one of the same beds as these stagger cells. After it undergoes UV treatment, the effluent is metered to a new outlet pipe and headwall for discharge in Gilbert Creek. So here's an overall site plan. This is the blower building up here again. This is a new control structure for effluent. Here's the new influent metering structure. These lines you see on the cells are the diffuser assemblies and laterals that aerate the cells. And part of cell number 2 will actually become a quiescent cell where before the effluent goes into the stagger structures, it will settle. So not the entire of cell 2 will be aerated. Up here you can see the excavated clay from cell 1 where it will be stored for use in construction. Here's cell 3. You can see that, you know, the eastern half is the stagger cells. The new lagoon effluent structure that will take the effluent from the lagoons into the splitter structures for the stagger cells is located here. And then here are the splitter structures in the western splitter structure, which is a secondary structure. The UV disinfection system will be located in the eastern part of that bed. So these are all below grade. A preliminary floodplain permit was issued for the new outlet headwall and pipe, which are the only improvements that will occur in the floodplain. And the project is anticipated to start this summer and have final completion by August 30th of 2019. There will also be improvements to the access drive and the existing perimeter fence. And there will be new warning signs placed around the perimeter fence as well as on the blower building. And I just wanted to show you this as well. So this is the new outlet area. And so this is the floodplain. And again, they've already obtained a floodplain permit. This is looking east from the entrance from George Washington Carver. And this is looking west onto George Washington Carver. This is looking north and northeast on cell 2. And the new blower building is all the way up here. I've got a closer shot, or the location of what will be the new blower building. You can also see the city of Gilbert over here. This is looking west on cell 1 towards, again, the new blower building proposed location. There's a construction trailer there now. This is looking west on cell 3, where the new Sagger system and UV site will be located. And this is looking southwest on cell 4, where some of the sludge from cells 1 and 2 will be relocated to. With conditional use permits, the board reviews the standards of approval and how the request meets those standards. So the first standard is compatibility. The majority of the new structures will be below grade. Again, only the blower building will be above grade and potentially visible. There will be soundproofing, however, on those blowers. And it is a metal utility building. It's 11 feet in height. And all adjacent properties are zoned A1 and in agricultural production, with the exception of the railroad to the east that separates this site from the closest dwellings inside the city of Gilbert. The existing footprint will stay the same as was previously approved. And I just noted that the closest dwelling was constructed pretty recently after, you know, the wastewater site had been established. And the wastewater site has been there for about 49 years. So it's been there a long time, since 1969. The site improvements overall will have a minimal impact on adjacent properties and are necessary for the operation of this wastewater treatment plant and to improve its operation. Regarding transition, the vegetation on the site is mainly located to the south of Gilbert Creek, and that does provide a buffer as well, kind of to the east between the railroad and the residential development. Again, the majority of structures will be located below grade. And given that there are no dwellings adjacent and the adjacent properties are in agricultural production, staff does not feel that additional buffering is necessary around that new blower building. The lagoons and cells themselves are also at a lower elevation. They kind of grade it down. That grading does provide screening. You can't really see those either. Regarding traffic, this is an existing use. It's anticipated that the current level of traffic to the site will remain the same. Staff will continue to primarily just visit the site for routine inspections. There are improvements proposed for the access, however, it will be regraded, compacted, a new rock will be installed, and a new gate will be installed on that access. For parking and loading, there's no public access to the site, so there's no minimum amount of parking required or proposed. Signs and lighting, they are going to be installing warning signs on the perimeter fence and the blower building. These signs are 24 inches by 14 inches, and a sign permit isn't required. According to the applicant, all lights will be directed downward. There will be some lights installed on the blower building and in other areas to light accesses. And the closest dwellings are, again, inside the city of Gilbert. There is a vegetative buffer there. the dwelling is located in unincorporated Story County that may be nearby or over 1,000 feet to the northwest. So we don't anticipate any major light trespass issues. Regarding environmental protection, overall the result of the project will be an improvement in the wastewater treatment plant's effluent discharge into Gilbert Creek. Given the open cell design, the applicant has further noted that stormwater, over 50% of stormwater that runs off on the site, is typically treated through the same process that the wastewater would be treated through because it falls into those open cells. There is also a stormwater pollution prevention plan to address runoff from construction activities, and we have already issued a floodplain permit for the work that will occur in the floodplain. And again, that's just the new outlet. If the board concludes that all development criteria will be met by the development, it shall approve the application and plans unless it concludes, based on the information submitted with the application materials and at the hearing, that if completed as proposed, there is a strong probability the development will not adequately safeguard health, safety, welfare, impair light and air, create congestion of roads, diminish property values, and not be in accordance with the intent, purpose, and spirit of the land development regulations and comprehensive plan. In your staff report, we went through all of these. I want to just touch on the last one, which is about being in accordance with the purpose and spirit of our ordinance and the Story County Development Plan, our future land use plan. This site, again, is located in the Ames Urban Fringe Plan. It's a natural area. Natural areas are part of the rural urban transition area in the Ames Urban Fringe Plan. And that area has a policy to permit interim development to occur in a manner that will support the long-term urbanization of the Ames Urban Fringe. And that's exactly what this is proposed to do. It will increase the wastewater treatment plant's capacity to allow the city's future growth to occur in a manner that will have adequate infrastructure to serve any new developments, whether that's residential or industrial. I also want to note that both within the Ames Urban Fringe Plan, the surrounding area is considered a planned industrial area. This area is supposed to be an urban in character, typically would be annexed as they're developed. The policy calls attention for us to specifically look at making sure there's appropriate infrastructure in these areas. And our C2C plan also has a similar policy. Our C2C plan designates this area as an urban expansion area to make sure that there's adequate infrastructure for future growth in these areas. And so the improvements will ensure that there's adequate wastewater infrastructure for the planned industrial area and other urban growth areas for Gilbert. So some points to consider. This is an existing use previously approved in 1969 and expansion in 1984. All work will occur within the existing footprint. The new system will increase the capacity of the plant and ensure the NPDES permit limits are met for E. coli. The improvements are consistent with the future land use designation for the area as they support future growth and adequate infrastructure. And the Iowa DNR will oversee the permitting of the discharges of the wastewater treatment plant and permits for the plant's design flow and bacteria effluent limit. So with that, just a few comments. The engineer office, after we routed this for interagency review, just noted that there is district tile to the east that shouldn't be impacted by construction. We sent notice to property owners within a quarter mile on July 24th and had not received any comments at the time of this report. We also routed this to the City of Ames, as they are in the Ames Urban Fringe, and had no comments from them. And so staff recommends the Planning and Zoning Commission approve the recommend approval of the request as submitted with no conditions. Questions?
What's the, I mean, it's How much is the improvement to the current operating capacity, right? It does a...
So maybe Matt with Fox can better answer that as the applicant and the engineer. But again, the existing system is a controlled discharge. So they have to, you know, wait 180 days versus this, which will allow continuous discharge.
Right.
So.
I'm just curious.
Yeah.
So there's not going to be any public access to this site anymore. The grade is going to be on Carver rather than down further.
The existing access?
Yeah.
Yeah, that will continue to be used.
Because there's no public access.
No. Just for the employees.
Yeah.
To monitor the system.
Mm. People have burned brush there, I know. Gilbert residents had burned brush there on that site. I don't know if they have lately.
I did a site review with one of the employees, and they said they used to do that, but don't anymore. And they were working on cleaning up the site and area.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I have a question.
We're actually going to have time for public comment here in just a moment. Thank you. Any other questions for the staff?
So the floodplain is adequately considered in this plan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's going to be a continuous discharge.
Mm-hmm. The floodplain permit was preliminarily approved in April. Prior to staff knowledge that this would be part of a larger improvement, the entire system. So the outlet was previously approved to be replaced. Yeah.
My only other question is about the noise, because there are some residential areas that are very close to that.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been in that area recently, and you know, it's coming right up against the railroad. And you can say, well, you know, people are living next to a railroad.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, this is going to be operating continuously. So I'm really concerned that there really isn't noise, rather than there's a low-level hum all the time that people are going to be dealing with.
Mm-hmm. We asked about noise. The applicant indicated that the blowers would be the main, because they're going to be aerating the system now. The blowers would be the main creator of noise, and that's inside of the blower building and then inside of a sound proof structure within the building. The applicant might be able to better describe the levels.
Yeah, I'm very interested in hearing about the levels.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Any other questions for the staff? Applicant or someone representing the applicant, if you'd like to address the commission, it sounds like we have some questions for you. If you'd step up to the podium and give your name and business address for the record, that'd be great.
Right, I'm Matt Hawes with Fox Engineering, and our address is 414 South 16th Street in Ames.
Did you have anything else you wanted to add to the staff's description of the building?
No, they described everything pretty well.
Okay.
I guess to address the comment on the noise, as Emily stated, these blowers they would be running continuously. Typically, with these sound attenuated enclosures, if you're in the building and they're running, it's kind of a, you know, it's a loud noise, but it's not loud enough where you can't have a conversation with the person standing next to you. So. Typically with those enclosures on these blowers and it being located inside a building, the noise you're going to hear outside is going to be pretty minimal. In most instances when you're at a plant that these are running, you don't hear them until you walk inside the building. As far as any outside noises you may hear that are different, you know, it is a controlled discharge lagoon now, so there's, you know, it's basically just a pond. There will be aeration system going, but it's going to be, if nothing you're going to hear, it'll just be, you know, air coming up from the water, pretty minimal sound.
So you're saying from the closest house, nobody should hear anything?
No, you shouldn't hear anything.
And Gilbert is continuing to expand south, so there may be houses that might be even closer in the near future.
Yeah, I think with the distance between the blower building to the railroad tracks, you know, I would guess there'd be more noise from the railroad than we hear from the blower building.
Yeah, that's a couple times today.
Yeah.
That's not continuous. Yeah. That's the point I'm making.
Yeah, I would, like I said, most of the time you don't hear these blowers when they're running outside the building, so I would assume from the east side of the tracks that they're not going to have any issues with the noise.
So again, the blower building will be located in this corner.
Yeah.
And the houses are over here. It says it's 1,307 feet. This line.
And where are the buffers going to be? The visual vegetative?
The existing vegetation is along Gilbert Creek here.
Okay.
There's no additional constructed buffer proposed.
No, not proposed.
There's existing buffer too on the east side of the road anyway.
Yeah, this one.
And I would say that just the natural terrain, you don't even see any of that from George Washington Carver because it's kind of up and over the side of a rise right there by Davis Farm.
But it's going to be, what, 11 foot tall building? So, yeah, but it's not.
There's buildings. That farm there is a Century Family Farm. And there's a couple of buildings there already, so yeah, there's not going to see anything.
Any other questions for the applicant?
Did that crack ever get up to the windows, ever? Like when we had the 10-inch rain in July, does it ever get up? Does anybody know?
No, to our knowledge, just never reached the top of the berms. Typically, to meet the design standards to DNR, any berms for these kind of lagoon structures would have to be elevated at least 3 feet above a 100-year flood elevation. So those berms are located high enough that whatever flood waters come through there, that they won't overtop it. At least it hasn't in the past.
Right.
We've
never had 10-inch rain
before
until
July 3rd. Any other questions? Thank you very much. And now we will,
I just have one quick question, a question about the capacity.
Yeah.
But just as a ballpark, how much will this increase the capacity of the water handle?
I have to double check the exact numbers on the full capacity, but basically the system is designed to treat Gilbert's wastewater flow for the next 20 years. Typically, it'll design to treat the system will last another 20 years.
I'm asking because I know that there's been a lot of limits on growth within Ames because of this issue. So I'm just wondering if, pardon the pun, but they unleashed the floodplains. Floodgates on being able to expand. We've seen what's been happening in Ames as far as growth and expansion. Once the wastewater is no longer an issue, I expect to see probably a lot of growth in Gilbert, in and around Gilbert. So,
yeah,
that's my only concern is it going to increase it enough to handle? I mean, if it's.
Yeah, they basically looked at what their anticipated growth is going to be over the next 20 years to make sure that system is designed to keep it. They're not something they have to come back in 10 years and just make it.
They probably will.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
No, I'm not sorry. So doing this enhancement is about being able to offer a continual release of clean water, rather than have it in a holding situation. Did I get that right? I want to make sure I got that right. And the advantages of that are?
With the current system, because you have to hold it for 180 days,
right.
Basically, right now, it's not necessarily that they can't treat the flow during a dry period like this. It's when they have the heavy rains in the spring. And because they have, the plant expansion was 30 years ago, they've exceeded the 20-year design. So it's basically, they're at a point where they're having to treat their flows because of domestic usage, and also they've got rainfall that comes in and contributes to that. So it's basically, they go to the continuous discharge system and contain all that incoming flow. Otherwise, if they wanted to continue to use the resource, they'd have to add more fuel cells and take up more time.
Sure. Thank you. I got it right. I just was double checking.
Okay.
Stephanie, do you have everything you need, even though he wasn't at the mic for the recording?
Yes, I know.
Okay.
Sorry.
That's fine. All right. Now we're going to open a public hearing for any comments on this, including questions. If you wouldn't mind, if you have something to ask or comments to provide, if you wouldn't mind stepping to the podium and giving us your name and address, please, for the record.
I'm Dave Turner. I live at 50552 160th Street. I own a piece of ground just southwest of the lagoons. Don't get me wrong. I'm all for this. Gilbert is growing, and it needs the capacity, but is that going to degrade my ground any? Or?
Staff and or applicant, would you like to address that?
Mm-hmm. You know, it's not an expansion, so the footprint won't really change. We anticipate it'll be largely...
I can't hear you. I'm sorry.
Okay. The footprint's not going to really change, so it's not going to encroach any further, if that's what you're asking.
Okay.
Are you concerned about value, though, or just how it's going to impact?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Could I ask this? Did the assessor's office have any comments in interagency review about value surrounding property or express any concern about property value changing?
Nope.
One way or another?
Mm-mm.
Okay.
The function's not changing, the footprint's not changing.
The use isn't really going to change it.
And like Amelia said, it's been there for 49 years. And so part of the plan is to be there for another long period of time.
Since this has been for 20 years, I'm 75 now. I guess I won't worry about it.
You're covered. But we've added it to the assessor's office because that is a standard to ensure that property values won't be impacted. And they didn't have any concerns.
No, I've just never been to a
planning
and zoning meeting. I thought it would be interesting.
Yeah.
Fool you. Okay, Dave, I have a question for you.
Yes.
Where is the land that you own?
Could
you? It's on the west side of Carver?
Southwest. No, it's on the east side of the dirt portion of
Carver.
South of the farm.
Oh, okay.
Is it...
south of the farmstead
here?
No, it's on the other side of your Russian farm.
That's west.
Oh.
On the east side. South there. Is that it?
You have a flatbook, I can show you.
Is it by the railroad? Is it adjacent to the railroad right away?
No, it doesn't run that far in.
Okay.
Is it south of 180 or is it north of 180?
Is it south of 180?
No. Runs along George Bush's and Carver and 180th.
Okay, just join the judges.
Yeah.
You know where it is.
I know where it is. If I can ask, just throw it to Tom's place.
Okay,
got it.
Okay, are there any other comments from the public? Sir, did that satisfy your question?
Yes.
Okay. I'm sure the staff will make themselves available too if you have more questions.
I'm just curious.
All right. We will close the public hearing then. And we will ask for action from the Planning Commission.
Chairman, I would move to approve CUP 08-18.
We have a motion to recommend approval of the conditional use permit. Is there a second?
I'll second that.
A motion by Cable and a second by McBride. Is there any discussion on the motion? Can we get a roll call vote, please?
Smith.
Yes.
Menz.
Yes.
McBride.
Yes.
Cable.
Yes.
Steele.
Yes.
Mergen.
Yes.
Sherman.
Yes.
Okay, that is a positive recommendation to the Board of Adjustment, Board of Supervisors.
Board of Adjustment.
That would be the next step along the way. Thank you so much, everyone.
Thank you.
Our next item is discussion of draft access requirements, a potential ordinance amendment. Amelia.
Yep. So we, as you know, our work program have an item to review our code of ordinances. And this is something that we've heard different issues with, just understanding what our current access requirements mean. So we kind of, one of the main things we worked on is clarifying for shared access easements. It previously stated that they shall be parallel to the front lot line and not exceed 50 feet in width. And I think the interpretation of that was a little bit cloudy, because when we think of what width is, for instance, a parcel, it might be different from something that we would, the width of like the right of way. And so what we've tried to clarify is that shared access easement shall not extend more than 50 feet beyond the front lot line of a parcel. So we get the question of what's the width of an easement out of it. Because that's, I think, the main, that was the main hang-up before.
Will you get the same question now about what the front is?
We have a pretty good definition of front lot line, I think. So hopefully it's clearer.
Okay. Yeah, the other thing, too, is there's kind of a mix of information in this subsection. It's broken out by information about access requirements along county roads. There's information about access requirements for new lots that are created through a process that involves the Board of Supervisors' action. And then there's language in there about access requirements for existing lots. So part of what we try to do, too, is to try to sort through all that and get those into niftier subcategories.
So now we have, instead of before, we had a provision on new lots, and within that provision, provisions on existing lots, so we've just separated those out because it makes sense. The other item that's changed or proposed, previously we had a provision for existing lots. In no case shall an easement provide access to more than four single-family dwellings, but that was just limited to existing lots. And we've recently had a concern where there was an existing easement and there were existing lots, but one of those is proposed to be subdivided. And how does that limit of four, which only technically applied to existing lots, apply when you're re-subdividing those? And we'd be open to comments on this, but at the end under four, you'll see for both existing and new lots, in no case shall an easement provide access to more than four single-family dwellings, or two or more two-family or multiple-family dwellings.
Is there any exception process to that?
That's a good comment. Not currently, but we could look at one.
I'm just saying, for new or existing? For an existing easement, right, let's say you have four lots. But let's say those are four, for sake of argument, 40-acre lots, right? And I bought one of those lots thinking, I'll subdivide this system, because I bought 40 acres. And now we're prohibiting that.
I
just want to make sure that we have
have
a way for people for it to be looked at.
Yeah.
And
at one point, though, I mean, part of what the ordinance says too is after four lots, there's a requirement to think about incorporating the road system into your development plans. So,
which is great, but if you're in a landlocked lot, with and you went to subdivide and nobody else does, then
build the road.
Build a road on
you build a road that extends through other lots to get to divide. Right, it honestly worked out, but
right. I just
That's not as currently. We're more than four new lots.
We're potentially changing the rules in the middle of the game. So I just want to make sure that that there is a way forward for somebody that's, you know, that there is an opportunity for exceptions where an exception would make sense.
Where you can't get access from a county road, like you said, like a landlocked situation.
I mean, that's where you have an easement to begin with, right? I have no access to a road, and I have to go across somebody else's property.
Right now, you can up to four.
Theoretically, you would have charged the planning development office before you bought that land.
And they would have said, "What? We're changing it." So whatever they said before is irrelevant because.
Oh, if you currently own it, and then the ordinance is changed.
Right. That's what I'm saying.
Okay. I see what you're saying now. You bought it under the existing ordinance.
If you're an existing landowner,
assuming you can do blank, and then the ordinance is still grandfathering in or grandmothering in.
Right.
Question.
Yeah. I mean, I think we give some thought to how many, you know, so if the max is four, you allow one, do you allow another? You know, at what point do you have too many serving a single access with a driveway situation?
We haven't had that out by us right at the moment. There's three lots been for sale for a long time on 680th. And they all sell because they can't get an access to the road.
Are they landlocked?
They're at the end of the road, and there's four houses that's already on that road.
So you can't build a house.
There it is.
You can't build a house.
They need to be able to put a driveway at the end of those three lots.
I think they just applied and got a permit for one.
I hope so, because that is a bad situation there.
Gravel
road.
Yeah.
You know, it's different if it's a highway.
Sure. I think the reason that there is a limit on the length of an easement and the limit of a number of dwellings on an easement is because, you know, we don't have an adopted code. So, you know, if you were using an access easement in a city, they'd have a fire code that would apply to that easement where it's, you'd have to have your easement that would be able to support like the weight of a fire truck and have an appropriate turnaround if it dead ended, but we don't necessarily have that.
Right. And I'm not arguing about whether or not it's necessary, because I believe it is. I just want to make sure that, again, if in situations like this where people have talked about and maybe bought land thinking under the existing rules I would be able to do X, and now we're changing it, and X no longer applies, then...
Yeah, we don't have an exception now, I mean, for existing lots, and what we're doing is adding so that new lots can be served by the single access. But on that concept, it would have to be buildable to begin with, all right? I mean, if it's not buildable, then that's not an option anyway.
They were to go the four, right?
All right. I apologize if you already said this, but this applies to proposed lots, parcels, and tracts.
This whole thing?
Yeah.
It
applies
to both existing.
For both existing.
So if I own a parcel that is separated from the nearest right-of-way or any right-of-way by another parcel, and I want to build on mine, it's otherwise buildable, but it's 300 feet back there. I cannot meet the access requirement by having a 300-foot access easement across the property next to me.
Can you get an easement for that?
Property owner next to you?
That's what I'm asking.
So, under provision 2, it's for existing lots. Any lot, parcel, or tract that exists that does not abut a public or private road shall have an access easement 20 feet in width, where, so that, again, the limit of 50 feet from the front doesn't apply. In cases where there's two or more single-family dwellings or one or more two-family dwellings, a minimum of 50 feet in width shall be provided. Does that answer? So you could have a snaking easement if it's existing.
That's our term, sneaking. Which means extending from the county road back. To like Marvin was talking about plan lot.
But you can't create new lots, parcels, or tracts that would take access. So existing are kind of...
So if you owned that lot that you're talking about...
No, I know that. I know what you're saying.
You couldn't subdivide it.
And we didn't change that or add that.
Okay, but you can't do that now. The subdivision needs to have street frontage access right now.
Right.
Except if it's a residential parcel subdivision, which is just a simple...
Which is unusual.
Right.
I mean, for a long, long time, that's been the case. A full subdivision plat needs to have...
I'm not talking about full subdivision. I'm just saying... Let's say you own the lot and you want to give one to your brother, right?
Yeah.
Subdivide, let him build a house. There's four houses out there. Subdivide, you can't build a fifth house.
We should be able to anyway. That should trigger the full subdivision platting requirements at that point. You can't just keep single splits.
No, no. So there's four lots, okay?
Okay.
That each one has a house on it, and you share an easement.
Yep.
You're in one of the back ones. You want to subdivide and build a fifth house.
Right. That should trigger the subdivision platting, full subdivision platting requirements now.
Mm-hmm. If you own
by state law,
one
state
of the lots, there's four.
Yeah, because there's four already. I mean, you're only supposed to, regardless of our regulations, you're only supposed to be able to divide by state statute into no more than two pieces without a full subdivision plat.
But if you're only dividing yours into two pieces,
it's a cumulative set of divisions. It's the accumulation of divisions over time. It's not just at any given moment. Otherwise, you could have perpetual divisions of land without ever triggering subdivision requirements.
Okay.
But what I'm wondering is, so... you may have already answered this, but you're saying that case where you have a landlocked parcel, you're not doing any divisions, and I want to build a house on that back parcel.
Is it buildable?
Is it buildable? Can I get an access easement? But doesn't 2A conflict with 1B? Don't they say the opposite things?
Well, I think the first one's really for one, for that first access that's going to be provided, and it says it's got to be at least 20 feet in width, and then A, and again,
we didn't.
But it says the easement can't extend 50 feet beyond the front lot line. That would tell me that the maximum easement to provide access is 50 feet long.
The 50 feet is the width, and again, I think it can extend. It can snake back to up to four.
That's not what it says.
So in 1B it says shared access easements shall not extend more than 50 feet past the front lot line. That tells me I can't reach my landlocked parcel because my easement can't be more than 50 feet.
Aaron, I think what that means is the access to the public road can be more than 50 feet back in. And from there, you could use an easement back to your lot.
But we're talking about that access is granted by easement.
So I think this is, again, for new driveways for proposed lot one. But we could further clarify that.
For proposed, but doesn't the same thing apply to existing? But that would be... Okay, so a newly drawn parcel.
Yeah.
Well, it says existing or proposed. And again, that was existing language. But the idea is to be efficient with these easements and not allow them to be extended and extended and extended. And then we have lots.
So understand not wanting to provide access to more and more development lots off the easement.
Mm-hmm. But the intent is to still allow an easement. If you've got an existing lot, it's buildable. Sure. That's the intent. I will review this to make sure it's not confusing.
Yeah, just they appear to conflict.
Yeah.
And the first part, that's county roads. Mm-hmm.
Because I think what you're going for is two different pictures of two different things happening. Mm-hmm. If I've got two
two parcels of land, two lots right next to each other, and they each want a house, but it's unsafe to provide two different driveways right next to each other, so close to each other.
Mm-hmm.
That's what 1B talks about. But 2 talks about a completely different thing, but it uses exactly the same language. It still talks about access easements.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you could say, maybe what you're saying, implying, is that in 2, it's not a shared easement.
It's just a...
because you're just using it to get to that back parcel. But what keeps it, by definition, from being a shared easement? The property owner grants the easement to that other guy behind him. That's by nature a shared easement. An easement is by nature shared. So a shared access easement doesn't really have any unique meaning. Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
I guess my main concern is I want to make sure that if you have one landlocked parcel and you want to build on it, it's otherwise buildable. If you can negotiate with the property owner between you and the right-of-way,
mm-hmm.
I don't want to get in the way of that civil agreement between two property owners to provide access to that back
mm-hmm.
property.
Yeah, and I think that was the intent.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's what it is existing currently.
So the situation where you know where we're at, they have three, they have four houses now, and then the three lots that are for sale at the end of the easement road, right off into the gravel from Hickory Grove.
Mm-hmm.
They say they can't, they don't have a road to get to those three lots.
Mm-hmm. And maybe I'm thinking of a different one, because there's just one for sale, and they do have frontage.
No, it stops right there, and they say they can't build that frontage road on.
Huh.
But there's three lots.
I might be confused.
I'm not sure, and I understand, you say we don't have code for certain things out in the county. So you're trying some ways to limit, you know, the number of developments or number of houses.
Mm-hmm.
But you're not really dealing with the issues like fire trucks not being able to turn around. You're not really dealing with those. You're just minimizing the bad things that could happen. Is that fair? I mean,
really, it's really two things. Organizing, because again, we have access information for how you obtain access on a county road, how you deal with existing situations, and then proposed lots that are created, access situations, and then clarifying, you know, the depth of the easement. Again, there's a number of situations where there's up to four landlocked lots that are buildable, where that it's obtained through a single access point through a private driveway situation.
Mm-hmm.
But four seems to be the threshold, but you certainly can consider, and you know, maybe scenarios where that could be added to.
Mm-hmm.
But under subdivision, if the proposed subdivision has more than four, then it's considered a major subdivision. In that case,
all the street standards, and it's no longer an easement, it's dedicated to the public,
right.
The space for the roads and the access point.
Okay.
So you're just trying to make the easement situation a little less Wild West and clean up the language, which was confusing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
I like that.
Other questions or comments? It's just a discussion item right now, so.
It'll be coming back. We've primarily done internal review.
Yeah.
We just didn't want to get too far ahead of ourselves. So we kept really finding some input, so we definitely appreciate it.
All right. Then we have the discussion of the Lisa Work Program item from Ryan.
Yeah, this is something that's on our work program. There's been a discussion with the Planning and Zoning Commission about trying to maybe consider a process or a system that would be maybe more accessible, easier to respond to for the general public, maybe perhaps get this information on our website.
We found out that there's six counties in the state that have a land valuation site assessment, and we obtained information from two of them, and I wanted the opportunity to have Ryan kind of share his analysis. I think he did an awesome job of the information that we obtained. We're still trying to get additional information to kind of compare it to, but he has an interesting take on the information that he analyzed. And two, this is going to be, he's got one more week with us. So, again, I wanted him to kind of visit with you about what he and Doug have been working on. So.
Yeah, so we can get started just with a quick kind of background and history of LISA here. So it's just a tool used by staff to identify parcels' relative agricultural value and suitability for development. It's used alongside the C2C comp plan and ordinances to review development. It's split up into two portions. So the land evaluation portion is soil productivity, and we use the Iowa corn suitability rating for that. So points are allocated for that. Pretty straightforward. Really what we're working on is the site assessment portion, which is, you know, a multitude of factors, anywhere from the distance to a municipal boundary to kind of adjacent zoning. And a lot of that has some subjectivity in it that we're trying to kind of flesh out. Story County adopted LISA in 1985. This was on the work program. Six other counties utilized LISA. And so we reached out. We gave all of our information, everything we use with LISA to those counties, kind of you know, hoping for voluntary feedback and, you know, kind of collaboration on what they use. So a couple of key findings we got, information from Blackhawk County and Linn County, was that neither county kind of post scores online. All scores are calculated by staff. Transparency is achieved through kind of robust FAQ sections on the website and so just a overall LISA explanation. The tool is used alongside ordinances, subdivision regulations, and building codes. So it's not just like a decisive mechanism, okay, here's my score, I can build on my land, or here's my score, I can divide my land. It's used in collaboration with a lot of different other tools. The inputs are constantly changing, so keeping up-to-date data and information is really important. A more stringent use of definitions specific to LISA probably should be adopted going forward. It's possible to make the entire system completely automated through the use of GIS. Linn County does that. But the initial programming would be a substantial undertaking along with continued data maintenance. And then questions can be changed as well, but that's also another substantial undertaking. You would want to kind of go back and do a random sample of your new criteria against like old LISA scores that have been run to kind of see how it would change those scores and make sure it's basically what you're expecting. So then just a couple of interesting features from Linn County. They actually used a whole separate initial system, minimum level of service, before running LISA. So that just measures a property's distance to CAFOs, a hard surface road, and fire station. So with that set of criteria, a property must first pass this before it can move on. If it doesn't pass it, then it's just deemed you know, not adequate for development. And that's all through GIS as well, completely automated. And another interesting feature of Blackhawk County's LISA process is that it's very similar to Story County's, which is the wording is a little bit simpler and more intuitive. So,
any questions on the first part of that?
Do those other two counties use LISA just as an evaluation tool when they get a development application, a rezoning, a subdivision proposal, or do they use it as a day-to-day administrative tool? Like, because we use it in both ways, right? evaluate a big development proposal that somebody submitted an application for, but we also use it to tell somebody, if you want to build on a parcel in the A1 district, don't just look at the map to determine what zoning district you're in. We have to run this so you can know.
Right. Yeah, Blackhawk County uses LISA for every single rezoning, conditional use, use exception, and special permit application. So less administratively maybe than us, but you know, more on those applications. So that comes out to about 50 a year for them. And I think, you know, we use it for that property research type. They come in and say, you know, what can I do with my land? And that's when we run LISA as well.
Property billable origin, I divide.
Does Linn County use it to determine if a single property is buildable in a particular district like we do?
I don't know if they, you know, exactly for what instances they use. They didn't kind of list out. They didn't list out their purposes like Blackhawk County did. I do know though that they have differing scores depending on kind of the land use that the property is currently involved with.
Okay.
So, you know, a score might be 115. That would be allowable for an agricultural area, but you know, a different score would be allowable for development in, you know, maybe a residential land use area.
Okay.
Of the two, you said Blackhawk is most similar to the system that we have. Are they using similar questions?
Yeah, six questions are almost exactly the same with another one that's pretty similar. Yeah, they said when they developed theirs, might have been in the 90s, that they kind of did a similar situation where they looked for collaboration to a few other counties, and Story County was one of them that they utilized information from. Yeah, I think with Blackhawk County in particular, well, and Linn County, they utilize natural resources, you know, when they're considering lots for buildable development. For us, Story County only utilizes or kind of measures agricultural land or adjacent ag zoning. But I think it'd be really important to kind of incorporate natural resources into that kind of definition of agriculture when you're considering if an area should be developed or not. So that's a really big portion.
That would be a way to use the watershed assessment. That would be a way to use the watershed assessment. Actually utilize the information on the sorts of information in the watershed assessment, yeah, for sure.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and then just Linn County was a very, very like sophisticated, robust, clear system with, you know, multiple questions, multiple factors. You know, it was all automated by GIS.
Did they talk about how they actually, did they have to write code to do that?
Yeah, the person I was talking with said they could even kind of put us in contact with the individual that helped them, but they have it so far where like a report gets made even afterwards that pushes out all the information automatically. So it's a very robust system.
I guess we really can't speak on the programming part of this.
So you could do it with a script, but you could use Model Builder too. It just depends on your questions and how clear they are. If the computer can answer them itself or not.
Can we talk about how you guys use GIS? In the process?
Yeah, so currently we use GIS for answering almost all of the questions.
So you go one by one.
And we do it by hand.
They kind of point and click.
Right.
And I'll tell you, there's a time difference in the amount of time that it takes me to go through the process compared to the time that it would take the plumbing staff. And part of that is because they do them probably almost the entire day. But it is time consuming.
Yeah, but we could automate it. But with some of our questions, it would be a matter of kind of updating those so that the computer would have clear, yes, this is an agricultural use, no, this is not, versus, because when I look at it, when Emily or Jerry or Ryan looks at it, we say, oh, there's a cow. I don't see any row crops, but I can see cows on this property, and how does the computer know?
Yeah, is it row crops, or is it used for, you know, livestock production?
Right.
We're trying to take out as much as we can the subjectivity and the evaluation.
Would it be possible at a lightly scheduled meeting in the future for you to actually run through a LISA for us as you would actually do it in the office?
Yeah.
Because I don't think that we understand. It's a bit of a... Actually, one of my concerns about LISA in general is that it's a bit of a black box.
Mm-hmm.
It just spits out a score without understanding, the public generally understanding how it works.
Mm-hmm.
So if we can't claim to understand how the black box works, then I don't know that we can discuss it in depth. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'd also like kind of an idea of where you're going. What's the overall goal here? It's just to make it look more like other counties, or is it to achieve some outcome?
Well, I mean, I think based on some of the feedback that we've gotten from the commission is it possible to have a system that's more readily accessible to the general public so that they can look at some type of resource map document to make some of these decisions? And so far what we're finding is there's a lot to that process. And so far, it's the staff in these counties, it's the staff here that are going through that process, running the report, doing the evaluation, and then coming to the conclusion.
And
that doesn't mean we can't have some valuable information.
And I think related to that is also how widely publicized is it that there's even this type of evaluation that happens in agricultural land use, right?
I'm
going to rely on you guys who are, you know, long-time agricultural owners and to say, I mean, is it well known out there that if you want to change land use, that there's this system that scores the land on to help determine whether or not you can?
I don't know anything
about it. Right. So I think that's part of it, is not just can the public get to it to use it themselves. I would worry less about that, as I would worry more about the fact that nobody knows that we spit out this number to help determine whether or not, you know, changes are going to be acceptable.
Well, folks don't even know their zoning district sometimes.
Right. So I would worry more about publicizing that there is this utility in use to help determine, to make sure that people, when they're applying or looking at things, to say, by the way, there is this, you know, LISA that's going to happen, right? This assessment's going to happen to help determine. And then, you know, educating and publicizing that it even exists and is used and how it's used is step one. Step two would be, you know, the follow-up question to that, when you tell somebody, oh, by the way, your land's going to be scored, to know whether or not you can do what you want to do, the follow-up question is how's that scoring done? Right? I would worry more about number one than number two.
And we need to know in the meeting.
At first, they do.
I mean, while you're doing one, let's do the other two. So
you can't really do one without
two. Right.
Because when you are constructing sentences, I've done this other times, when you are structuring a system like this, you have lots of if-thens, because the computer only knows on or off. And so you have different tiers of information. There's a sort of a general level that certain people might be interested in. But exceptions, getting all the exceptions in, is all the if-then stuff. And it can be done, but it's not just a yes and no kind of situation. I mean, you can get to that because it's either going to say yes, this plot, well, what is it? Is it in the general area? Is it in the if-then stuff? To be done, but it's a big job. It's such a big time. Somebody like you could do it.
Linda, I have a handful of specific concerns about the LISA that I've expressed before, which
may have played a role in it landing on the SAS work program. Mm-hmm. One of which is that we use it, I think it's a very good planning tool that we use as an administrative tool. So we use it to make decisions about what our future land use plan should be look like, and we use it to evaluate the appropriateness of development, proposed developments and rezonings, but we also use it on a day-to-day basis. So I'm in the A1 district.
Mm-hmm.
If I go to the staff and say, can I build on my parcel in the A1 district, it says that single-family homes are allowed. The answer isn't, let me double check. Your parcel's this color on the map. Yes, you can build if your lot meets the setbacks and that sort of thing. The question is, it depends.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a completely unacceptable answer to give to the public. And I've thought it for how many years? It's 2018. I've thought it for 15, 16 years that's just a poor way to deal with the public. Everywhere else, I can tell you whether you can build or not based on the zoning map. The zoning map is supposed to tell you something. Like you said, Jonathan, most people don't know their zoning.
Right.
But then go to a map and find it. Can they go to a map and find if they can build a single family home in the A1 district? No. It takes a significant amount of research from you guys to know the answer to that.
Well, and does that answer it, or does that just influence the answer? Right, that's the other part of it. So you have a LISA score. Does that mean does that mean the LISA score absolutely prohibits it?
It does answer it, but here's part two of my pet peeve.
You're correct.
Okay, it answers it until next week or the next 6 months or the next year when all the conditions around that parcel change, which affects the score. Okay, so it's fluid.
Yeah.
What the answer is today may not be next year.
Well, of course not, because things change.
Right. There's a good thing about it, though.
Yeah, I don't see that.
Yep, but the next time you want an answer to the question, can I build, you have to come back and pay the staff another fee.
It's
to
find out.
Right?
Only $30.
And then my third one on a related note is it's manipulatable. That there are actions that the property owner can take that affect the score, the LISA score of the parcel. And this is not the fault of our staff, and it's not really the fault of the LISA. The LISA was a really innovative tool back in 94. I think Story County was the first to implement it, and others have modeled after us. But it's unchanged since 1994 for the most part. One thing I'd like to know is, I know it would take a lot of programming work to automate it, and you hit on that, on this. The first thing to do before you invest in automating it is to find out, if we got rid of all those subjective questions in the evaluation, all the subjective parts, how much would it really change? How many, the answer to the property owner, would it have changed in very many cases? As opposed to if we just use the objective parts.
Well, I can tell you right now, when it's close on can this is buildable or not, or can they divide it, if Amelia's doing it, it goes to Emily to do the same evaluation, and they don't talk until the second time until she.
Sure. But if you wrote,
what happens?
If you did if you started from scratch and you did your best job of writing a completely objective, measurable by a computer in an instant, Lisa. How many times would the result have been different from having the subjective components in it? Right.
Well, how much does the human evaluation influence the LISA score? Right. Is that kind of where you're going?
Right. It may, because we may find out that it only affected 20 scores over 20 years. It's worthwhile for the better information to
or
the public.
Or it's a percent variable. Right, it swings it this way or that way by 10%, right?
Right.
Do we care about that 10% enough to say, let's just use the raw score and then make it available to the public?
I really like the idea of this group seeing how a LISA score is put together, but not just one.
How many do you want to do, Linda?
I don't know.
I have a staff of property. You can come on down tomorrow.
I have a lot of time. No, but I really mean, because situations are different. You know, you could take one situation, and it could just be an outlier. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm concerned about. And it might be interesting to, I mean, not to go through the whole thing, but explain how Lisa works, how you get the score, and then show us maybe three examples of something about, you know, that you think are things that, you know, maybe are most common or ones that are exceptional. You know, I just, because it's not going to be the same thing for every property. I don't think, yeah. I think we do need to know more, because I think as this county develops, it's going to get more and more common.
Sure.
And if that's what we're relying on to give people the answer, we better be sure we have what we want and know what our objectives are clearly in doing it.
The objective is to protect prime agricultural land, right?
That's the goal, protect the prime farm ground. Whether it be production or livestock.
These are actual Lisa questions that someone would answer and then get bumped in that
yeah,
right
with, yeah. And the Blackhawk County one, I go through every single one that
does. I have a question about this piece of paper. So are these actual Lisa questions?
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And depending on another answer, they're given points or ends. So this is something that people sit and kind of click through.
Right.
What we're saying.
Yeah.
At this point, at this example.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Well, we'd be happy to go through, you know, the full process at a future meeting where there's some other.
I think that's great. It's hard to have a conversation about it until we know the work you guys do on this every day.
Yeah. I can think of some fun ones.
I think we did do one for some of the newer commissioners.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, I think I attended a meeting where we went over it at one point.
Sure.
I just had a couple points, and I realize the storytelling is not using this in these analysis, but should we include wooded acres as agricultural land? And I know you don't yet, but I think some counties do.
Unless that's like a part of, you know, you plant, you harvest, you produce, then it's an acre.
I understand that part. Okay. Second one is, as you all know, I'm for government, trying to run my life more. This is to Fire and Rescue Services. Why do I care? If Amanda wants to go out and build a house 300 miles from a hard surface road, a fire department, or a fire rescue, why should I care? Why should anybody care?
Yeah, it just gets to the urbanization of an area. I mean, the closer you are to an incorporated area, the, you know.
So you gain points by being closer to this and that. I have
or
a
you think
that,
that's the one that that?
We don't have that one.
Yeah, that's
I realize that.
Yeah.
It's higher points and less buildable.
It just depends on the county.
For Story County, yeah.
Yeah.
Other counties.
Many counties in first, yeah. You have to have a high score in order to develop.
So usually if you're fairly close to a city, you're going to probably have a low land evaluation size assessment. But then in a lot of cases, we're going to be dealing directly with the city if there's a development plan, so that if they do develop it, it's consistent with the city's plans.
So getting back to, you know, getting on Jerry's bandwagon about let's make sure that we're telling people what they can do with land that they own. If it has a high Lisa score, are we going to tell somebody that they can't build on it?
That's what happens.
So we do that.
That's what happens.
And this is primarily for dwellings.
Okay, we're doing this. But then we also do it if somebody wants to submit a conditional use permit for, you name it.
We have to do this evaluation.
So let me throw out a scenario and then you tell me.
Let me do a clarification.
Okay.
You have to have 37 acres in an A1 to build, right?
35.
35.
Okay.
So if you have 35 acres, at least it does not come into play.
I own 1,000 acres, and I have a residence that's a 100-year-old farmhouse, and I want to build a new house to replace that.
1,000 acres probably broken up into 40-acre allocate parts, probably, right?
Okay.
Is the new proposed area for this new dwelling on a 40-acre?
On the same 40-acre. I want to build it. I don't want to go someplace else.
Then you might be able to apply the survey splitting off the farmstead. That's one of the exceptions in any one district. And if the balance is 35 acres, then that would be built.
I have... Okay.
You can do it. I tell you how to.
So I have row crops planted right up to my fence line that's 20 yards from my house. I'm going to build my new house on the other side of that farm, on the other side of that fence. It's going to eat into what is now existing row crop land.
You have 35 acres?
While I build it.
Yeah, do you have 35? If you do, you can do it.
35 or more, correct?
35 or more.
Right.
It's only when you have fewer than 35, you're going to have fewer than 35 that you have to look at.
Or the only thing you can park in the fire department is when you're splitting off your farmstead, you create a large enough area so that it can be split again with a residential parcel subdivision to create that second one. And that's why that was adopted in 2012.
Right.
To allow landowners that second bite of the apple to give them a second option.
I've been here a while doing this, and I don't know that we've ever seen a lease score that exceeded. I don't know that I've ever seen an application come across, tell me if I'm wrong, where the lease score exceeded our threshold. And we told somebody, no, you can't do it.
That's because they get filtered out before they get here. If they don't.
That's what I'm thinking.
That's what the interagency review is for, and they have conversations with staff. And
gotcha.
Administrative review said, no, you can't do it. So it doesn't come to us.
So you might have the acreage, and you might have the answers, just no, you can't build there because it's good farmland.
Yes. This is all about preserving the farm ground, and the roots are in our comprehensive plan. You know, everything starts with that. And so we've got some viable farm grounds in this country.
So regardless of how you philosophically how you feel about that particular thing,
right?
My question is, shouldn't you at least know it without having to wait 10 days and pay a $35 fee?
10 days?
I don't know. How long does it take?
3 to... Don't ask him that.
Depends on how tall the stack is, right?
How long is that stack?
You've got
100 feet.
If it's only X number of days, then I think you just...
Yeah, right. But that's my complaint right now is whether or not you agree with the 35-acre minimum as an effective way of preserving prime farmland. Shouldn't you be able to know without paying a fee
whether or not
you can build on your parcel or not?
In Lynn County, they don't even have that level of access to the lease score for someone to go online to a map and point and click. They don't have that level of access for the.
It'd be great if it was just incorporated with GIS, right?
Right. Well,
what does Lynn County use it as an exception to a large lot? In an administrative capacity like that, or do they use it just to evaluate development proposals?
We'll ask them.
Because
how much do they charge, and how long does it take for?
I didn't ask them how much they charge.
They're completely automated. Like the system even sends their.
But they have a two-stage process. If it doesn't
meet the first stage, they don't even run the second part.
That's the fire station and the
CAFO.
It goes to a CAFO and
confinement.
Hard surface road.
We can ask.
But again, this is just the first stage. We don't want to get too
far. Yeah, it's good information.
Good job, Brian.
Yeah.
Also,
yeah.
Admire your excellent work on your name badge there. I see
Gary
and Amelia and Ryan.
Are there any other comments on Ryan's memo?
Was there more?
I think we kind of... Was there more to this?
Yeah, we're still
kind of far away. Yeah, is there anything else you want to add?
Well... No, I mean, the main part would be if you look at the Blackhawk County comparison, it actually does go through 1 through 10 each of the Story County questions and compares it to Blackhawk County. And then a couple of that Blackhawk County have in addition to that for that is different. And then Lynn County, I just go through Lynn County's questions because they're a lot different, so I don't even really try and make them.
What other counties did you request information from?
So there's two here. There was Johnson County, Muscatine County. Jasper and Van.
Van Buren? No, that's it.
With 99 counties and only six doing this.
Yeah.
So are we cutting in?
What do the other counties do to evaluate? Where do they just
probably just the ordinances that drive?
Yeah, and some don't have zoning.
Yeah,
it's
software.
Yeah, they don't
want
to spend the money.
There's probably 30 counties that don't have software.
Okay. Anything else you want to add about this, about which direction this goes in the future? Okay, then we'll at some point in the future we'll sit down and do a Lisa together.
Right? Yeah, we'll go through one.
Yeah.
Or several.
They don't want more than one.
Okay.
We should bring actual. We'll bring.
Okay.
Then we will run. We will go to the discussion of the home business ordinance amendment.
Okay, this is a proposed amendment. You know, home businesses are permitted in most districts in the county. It allows somebody who has a dwelling to operate a home business. The county's ordinance does not specify, you know, what is acceptable for a home business. It just has to be a service or a product-oriented activity. Some ordinances actually list out what you can and can't do. But these are reviewed annually by staff, and you know, kind of a reoccurring theme that we're seeing when we do the evaluation, which normally starts by use of the aerial photography, is that we're seeing situations where there's more than one employee. I'll go through these real briefly. The ordinance requires at least one of the people that live or reside in the dwelling to be a part of the business, and then they can have one person outside of who might reside in the dwelling to operate in the business. So we're seeing a lot of situations where there's more than one person working from a site, and then there's situations where there's outdoor storage. So again, so the ordinance is pretty limited. It's kind of like an incubator. It allows somebody to run a business. It's supposed to be low-key, low-scale. If you're meeting these requirements, and I think these are pretty standard requirements that your neighbors probably are not even going to know that you're running a business. So it's got to be service or product-oriented. At least one person from the family residing in the dwelling is to conduct the business. You can't have more than 49% of the floor area, gross floor area of the house to be used for the business. You get one accessory building. There's no limit on square footage. It could be a 40 by 60, a 60 by 100, whatever it is. But only one.
Yeah, I have a question on that, on number four. It says in zoning districts where accessory buildings are allowed for home businesses. So in some zoning districts, I take it that they're not allowed.
Right, probably your residential districts.
Oh,
because, again, if you're closer to your neighbor, smaller lot sizes, you know, in an A1 district, you could have a 35-acre lot, you could have a 10-acre, a 5-acre. But in your R1, it's a 25,000 square foot lot, so you're in closer quarters, and so you're not permitted to run the business out of an accessory structure. And then it gets into the nuisance things. You know, it can't cause odor, gas, dust, smoke, noise, that type of thing. Only one person living outside the residence, and members of the immediate family. Maybe employed, which I already went through. You've got to meet parking requirements. The references are general parking regulations, so usually that means there's going to be like a handicap accessible space, which isn't that difficult to meet. Usually you're probably going to have a sign posted, and then usually the route from the parking to the house or the building should be accessible. And then the
Next thing talks about number of vehicles, limited to 2 service vehicles in an A1 district. But the subparagraph after that says, and the way we interpret it is, it doesn't limit it to 2, and those can be seen from an adjacent property or the right-of-way. But then there's restrictions in an AR, R1, or R2. It says all vehicles must be fully enclosed within a building, again, which is kind of getting to limiting the impact of the business to your neighbors, to the adjacent properties. Outside storage or display shall not be allowed. And the next one talks about traffic generation. And we just went through an amendment last year to try to gauge that by allowing up to 6 trips per person residing in the dwelling, maximum, to try to get an idea as to, you know, how much traffic you can have to and from. So it really should relate to a similar activity that you would typically see in a residential setting. The next one, 10, talks about not impacting property values, no negative effect there. Signage, you have to meet the sign code requirements. Lighting requirements. Let's see. And then really in all this, kind of what we found, we just had a rezoning request. It was a home business permit that actually expanded over time with number of employees, outdoor storage. And, you know, we had some discussion about really not having any provisions in here for transitioning. You know, you've got simple requirements, but what if you're a business that either has or wants to go beyond the limits that are provided here? You know, how does that happen? And so what we would be proposing is to, when we do an annual review, if we notice through aerial topography, which usually involves a site review, if we notice something, we communicate with the landowner, ask to meet on the property. But if violations are noted, that we give the property owner, home business owner, time to either voluntarily comply or work through those items that are not compliant, to transition to a location that's zoned for that use, or the entire home business to transition. Because that's really what it's supposed to be about. Either you operate your business within the compliance specifications of the home business ordinance, or you relocate to a district like a commercial and industrial district, or maybe it's a heavy industrial district, and then meet those requirements so that you're in a similar area of similar uses, zoned for that activity. So basically, this would provide that transitioning period to allow voluntary compliance within a year's time. And then they would comply with the requirements, move those parts that aren't compliant, or again, seek a location with zoned for use. So that's kind of what we were thinking for this amendment.
Jerry, so if somebody's not in compliance now, are they going to be able to stay in business?
I can tell you currently, it references the enforcement process, which is 9211. I can tell you practically how we do it. We send what we call a friendly letter, and we talk to them on the phone, ask to meet at the site, go through these requirements, and ask for a compliance schedule. And if we can work out some type of agreement, whether it be a 30-day, 60, or whatever it is, then we'd rather always do that voluntarily than to go right to violation, using the violation provision. So that's how we do it administratively. But I can tell you that we have quite a few active. They're not all home businesses, but we've got quite a few cases.
Well, we had a case just last month where this was enforced. Of course, we voted it down.
but the Board of Supervisors approved that and gave them till what, 2025?
In 10 years.
It was a rezoning request that was voted down, and then staff was suggesting that we use the home business permit application with conditions, because part of the concern from the applicant was that, you know, that he thought that, you know, maybe he was told something different from previous staff than the current staff with regard to requirements for operating the home business. So we wanted to take that element out of it and offer the conditions.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with Board Supervisor passing, you know, having to do that, but would he be able to do that if this was in effect?
Yeah. So, yeah, this provision would give somebody that's not compliant
some time, but would it give him years?
1 year. It would give him 1 year.
So you got to figure out till 20.
The next step.
10 years.
Ten years.
From the supervisors.
Yeah. So he got 10 years, so if he passes, he's probably still gonna have 10 years.
You're talking about a situation that, but anyway, I'm hoping he doesn't come.
I'll go on the record and say I think the supervisors grossly overstepped their bounds on that, and they don't have the leeway to make those kinds of decisions based on our code. So what does it put more reins on them in the future? I mean, there is a statement there which says it kind of takes away some supposed flexibility for the Board of Supervisors. Yeah, I would think.
I would think so.
And it takes flexibility away from us.
Yeah.
Well, to him also.
Well, I don't know that we have the flexibility that we...
That we exercise?
That we exercise, to be perfectly honest.
We didn't exercise it.
I mean, we were giving leniency to try to resolve it. I don't feel like the final solution was leniency to try to resolve it. It was just a 10-year.
We thought it was a fairly creative way to try to address the
office needs,
the staff needs, and then let the commission and the board ultimately make the decision.
So I like the intent of this. I like the creativity of it, but I think just the idea of creating a reward system for violating the standards.
Fortran is a better way to look at it, or a different way of transitioning.
I think I dove it into the nuts and bolts of the ordinance a little more. So you say things like, if after 2 years of being successfully in compliance, you want to request a 2-year expansion of the permit to allow an additional accessory building to be used or more square footage to be used or whatever, build in some little things like that, but they should be, my opinion is, they should only be available if they've demonstrated the ability to stay within the standards of approval, and then only for a certain amount of time because it's transitional, right? It's, I know I need to move to a new building in a commercial district. I'm not quite there yet. I'm at this dicey time when I can't afford it, but I'm too big for this, but I'm too small for that, you know.
And the reason that a person needs to move her or his business is because the conditions have changed around them. That was not within their control. They put perhaps a goodly investment into that business right here where it is, and the conditions change around them. They might have a really serious amount of money in that business.
Or they put the money in and build a second accessory structure because they needed to expand beyond the first one, and they are just flat out of compliance. So if they do something and they are out of, for whatever reason, whether it's intrinsic or extrinsic to the process of the business, if they are out of compliance, which is all we concern ourselves with, then what are the, you know, what remediation is there for?
I would say going further, though. If you're out of compliance because of your own bad actions, or if you're out of compliance for things that were beyond your control, I think those
are... How are you out of compliance for things beyond your control?
Because we changed the ordinance around on that area.
They do that every day in city government.
But then you're doing that every day.
Your non-conforming use.
Yeah, but with the home business, it's permitted through the through the permit.
Right.
I'm right, I'm lost.
Yeah, you've got a CUP saying you can run a home business.
Okay, when you say you're a non-conforming use.
That means the law changed, but it's like a grandfather.
A grandfather, exactly.
So the non-conforming use is, you know, the zoning changes, but you're okay to still do that as long as it's just you. If you change,
and as long as you continue to do it in the same way.
And that's exactly
a buyer, then you're
and that's exactly what the supervisors did, you know, and not getting into the question of how the applicant did this or that and whether, you know, good faith, I don't know. But that's what I saw the supervisor's action is doing.
Well, that my original question was, this ordinance is in place, that's not going to happen. Is that true?
I mean, they'll have a time to transition, but they're not going to have 10 years.
I think it makes it harder to. It has to. If that statement is there.
Yeah, I agree.
Because it provides a specific remedy for over time for resolving non-compliance.
And part of it is our input with that applicant was we provided what the options were in addressing it, which is find a location suitable for your zoning, which they didn't want to do, add on to an existing building to move the outside storage inside the enclosure, they didn't want to do that. Rezoning petition, and that's the option we chose, which ultimately
I don't care what. I mean, that to me, that's done. It's over with. Okay, and I'm just up. But that's not going to happen. You know, this is it, or can it?
I'm hoping that we don't ever see that again. But again, we have this ability to just go to enforcement. When we look at these and they're not in compliance, I can send a notice of violation, and they have 30 days to come into compliance with the ordinance. So we don't do that that way. We try to work with people, just, you know, maybe they don't know.
So functionally, I think a problem with stating it this way, again, I really like the point, I mean, like the direction you're heading, but stating it this way means no matter what the circumstance, no matter what the situation, you have to give somebody a year.
So you want to see compliance?
I mean, there could be a situation where compliance, it's dangerous, it's a huge nuisance, it's something, and compliance needs to happen right away.
Yeah, then we got to act. Sure.
If we look at the previous case, the neighbors came out and said that they really didn't care for the look of the piles of the wood. How do you prevent that?
So is the state corn dealer?
That's an agricultural
A2 type use agribusiness.
I mean, they started out in their garage. I know a lot of them started out in the garage.
Yeah, so for instance, you know, the, for instance, sheep seed corn dealer in Fernald, he's zoned A2.
Well, he's got a shed. He doesn't live there. I'm talking living there.
Yeah.
We all start out little.
Uh-huh. But when you get bigger, typically those are just zoned differently in zoning districts.
I just don't want to limit. We're an agriculture state.
Yeah, well, agriculture is permitted use outright.
And I think with the seed corn dealers, you know, the A2 agribusiness district, which would permit that kind of use outright, is an interesting district in that it's meant to be completely surrounded by, you know, the A1 agricultural district. You wouldn't have the same issues with spot zoning that you would if you were requesting to rezone to a commercial district. Rezoning to an A2 district to permit something like a seed dealership, something that's interrelated with agriculture, would be much easier for a home business that was related to agriculture and needed to rezone. I think that's less of an issue than home businesses that are just related to retailing and warehousing that doesn't have to do with agriculture.
And that scenario is required to be located in an area where you're adjacent to A1 agricultural zone, because that's who primarily they're providing services.
So it'd be much easier for someone who had a seed corn dealer that grew to just get a rezoning and come into compliance.
Right,
that
I just don't want to put too many restrictions on here that we can't grow. Mm-hmm. It starts out little.
So
a lot of young people are trying to do that right now. Mm-hmm.
So with Aaron's concern about the basically automatically granting somebody a 1 year. What if we just rephrase that for up to 1 year?
Up to?
And then do you have discretion to say you've got 30 days or you've got 90 days or, you know, 10 days or whatever, depending on what the infraction is, how long it's been going on, number of complaints,
I'm wondering
the intensity.
If by posing that as, I mean, the title of it is violation of the standards of approval. Basically, you're giving somebody a free pass to violate. You're saying, here's what happens if you violate.
Could be a different section.
Yeah, I just don't, right. I think you should put in opportunities to transition, but not by first violating the rules, seeing how long you can do it before the staff finds out, then you get your year that starts counting.
Yeah, so, I mean, there should be teeth, right, that says that there are fines for violation and times for violation that are subject to enforcement, right?
But what you're thinking, Aaron, is more like a, I've been in compliance, I have my home business permit, oh, and I put in a request as part of the annual review to, for a little bit of time.
So I think one way that this ordinance could be much better is positioning it as if it's an ongoing conversation with the staff to make sure that you're in compliance. So rather than waiting until you're in violation to take any action, if there were carrots out there to say, okay, I know I'm growing, I should go have a conversation with the staff. Look, there's this opportunity to apply for an expansion permit, which lets me do this, this, and this. I think I'm through that threshold. I better do that.
I think if you change, and this would change a lot, I think. Sometimes language is important. If you change any home business not in compliance to any home business no longer in compliance.
I would say in compliance for at least 2 years demonstrates some. It's not like we're suggesting to take away all uses of property here. This is a home business permit, which means they're deriving full use out of the property already by virtue of having a home. It just seems like it's okay to say, demonstrate to us that you can stand to the standards of approval for a couple of years, and then we have this option to go a little bit further if you need to start transitioning out of there. So that it's not this abrupt, your business is shut down or your business continues sort of thing like we had last month.
I also think the context matters in terms of what zone these proposed or existing businesses are in. If it's in the agriculture zone, you know, maybe the wood processing makes more sense there. But if it's in a residential zone, it doesn't make so much sense there. I know it makes it more complex to start thinking about these different zoning areas, but I think the context does matter of what people should be doing in their neighborhood.
You find out during the annual review, I mean, it says there's an annual renewal, that says renewal. I mean, that's where you catch things that are out of whack, is that correct? And then this has happened always, that you have to renew it every single year.
And we start by looking at aerial photography, and part of this is we don't, the counties have flown every year, so we're going to be using data that's current. We're doing it like every other year. We have been.
The pictures. So
the photos.
Yeah. They're from 2017 of March, currently.
But that's what we use for a basis to get an idea.
I think we got to keep in mind here, I am really in support of home businesses. I'd like to see them smartly expanded. And I'm all for getting full use and value out of your property. I'm also all for the neighbor getting full use and value out of their property. And I think you have to think, we as a group need to think about what it'd be like to live in a smaller lot subdivision like Squad Valley right next to a home business that is violating these rules. Do you want to give somebody who has propane canisters stacked up in their garage a year to come in compliance with the home business regulations, or acetylene tanks in their garage, or is really noisy? I mean, I'm all for giving the benefit of the doubt to the property owner, but which property owner?
That's part of what planning is all about, looking at the impact to adjacent properties or a neighborhood.
You could say, in that case, could have the 1 year, except if there were health and safety concerns, in which case there could be less, because doing something like that,
health, safety, and nuisance.
Yes, because what that would do is it would give some parameters on giving staff the allowance to give up to a year. It's guidance is what I'm trying to say. It would give some guidance and say we didn't give a whole year because there were propane tanks stacked up to the ceiling and blah blah blah. Yeah,
but I like Aaron's point though about if you're out of compliance, you're out of compliance and you need to get into compliance. Mm-hmm. If you're growing and you need to continue to grow, then there can be, you know, this transition, a transitionary period, you know, granted by exception, is what I would say, because it needs to be explicitly approved that you can violate the rules during, for a given period of time, you know, depending on conditions, right? So if you're a quiet, non-nuisance, safe home business and you need to do something that violates this to continue to grow, then staff can say, or us, or whoever it's up to can say,
make it so it doesn't violate it.
Well, or say, we'll grant you 6 months to get into compliance, whether that means moving expansion off-site or whatever. But I like the idea of saying you're not allowed to be out of compliance.
But shouldn't the point be to not? You don't want to perpetuate the environment we have right now, which is I bet I can violate those rules and they won't find out for 3 years. And then look what it says. I've got another year after that. I've got 4 or 5 years here before anybody.
Do you really think
really
everybody goes through that mindset?
How many cases do you have now?
Well, complaints, quite a few. Home business issues, there's a handful.
So I just don't, I mean, we're splitting hairs to a certain extent. But put in opportunities not to violate, put in opportunities to expand your compliance rather than violate.
Question, the ones you have right now, the home business violations, what percentage of those are people who have had the permit and have let that go versus people who never knew they had to have one?
Most of them are existing permits.
Most of them are existing? Okay, that's interesting, because I assume they get, at the time they get the permit, they get a copy of the ordinance or they know what the rules are.
They get a copy of it and there's a testing that they will meet and are meeting.
Okay. So if the rules change, do you let them know?
I don't know if we specifically highlight. Like, the only change that I'm aware of is the, you know, trying to get a hold on the threshold, the number of trips, because it's very vague before.
Okay. So you're saying you haven't changed it that often?
Just that,
that's the only one. And
traffic.
How long?
I mean, home businesses in all kinds of different zones. It just varies.
Yeah. I mean, most of them are probably in an A1 or R1 situation.
But I guess, what does the commission think about the provisions themselves? Because I think from a staff perspective, I think it's pretty substantial. You know, it allows somebody to operate a home business. The only criteria is you have to have a dwelling, and at least somebody in the dwelling should be a participant to the business, but otherwise, you know, especially if you're in an area where you've got adjacent neighbors, your neighbors are going to probably appreciate the fact that somebody's there living and keeping track of what's going on.
The one accessory building provision, there's potential for abuse there, but on the other hand, there's potential to solve problems here too. Like, if our applicant last time just built a really big building, pole barn, relatively inexpensively compared to buying a commercial or leasing a commercial building or buying a commercial lot, we would have had the problem solved because there's no limit on the square footage of that building.
Still have employees.
Continue employees.
Right. But the visual things?
Yeah, visual things.
Right. But on the other hand, somebody could basically have a whole factory run it inside a building on an agricultural lot, and is that okay? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, if the criteria is it a service or a product orientated activity? If it is, then
they can,
you can do it if you meet the other requirements.
They can run a factory inside a big accessory building with no noise, dust, you know.
Yeah, I think you can handle one of those things.
Yeah. So, seed corn. Or, I'm trying to think of something that's relatively innocuous.
Well, seed corn was being permitted out there.
As, right, in an A2 this year.
So, not to complicate it further, so big as, oh my gosh. But should there, I can see differences between in an A1 and an R1 district. But I don't think you want to go there, because then you're splitting so many hairs.
Just combine, if you want to try to treat everybody the same, and then when you don't, then...
Every situation is not the same.
Right.
I feel no sympathy for the people. And you're saying it's only happened once and it's been a very, very minor thing. But I still have sympathy for people who would start a business, put money into it on a certain place, and then the rules change on them, and they're not allowed to be a non-conforming use and stay there. It's kind of like people moving, you know, buying land and building a house right near the airport and complaining about the noise. Excuse me.
Yeah, these situations are treated like a permitted use. It's just that you need a permit, and then you have special rules that you have to follow. So it doesn't turn into a non-conforming use unless we were to change the ordinance and make it so you can't do a home business in that case. That would be a non-conforming situation.
Okay.
So does each zoning district say permit home business, or do all zones permit home business?
It states it, an accessory uses typically under the zone standard.
Most of the residential A1. You can have an apartment or dwelling in a commercial or industrial district. I'm not sure some of the home businesses are in there.
Yeah, in the districts with permitted dwelling, it's listed as an accessory use.
So you have to have a dwelling there or a principal permitted use.
So we're
all
just
discussing.
Correct. But
as
I would run out of discussion.
Well, I'm just still the vehicles that are in the building. That's still.
Well, again, you're in a residential district, so
A R.
Right, does it have agricultural residential? That's a 1-acre lot.
All service vehicles must be fully enclosed in the building.
So if your neighbor's running a business and has 6 service trucks, is that okay that they be visible in a AR that's a 1-acre lot, so it's a subdivision? I guess that's the question.
See, I'm different because I'm in agriculture and we have probably 15 tractors and we've probably got semis, and that would not bother me in the least.
Right, but that's permitted.
I know, but that's why I'm just trying to think within a building. So they have,
but if you lived in an R1 district with 25,000 square foot lots and your neighbor is...
Well, he said an acre.
Okay, let's say it's an acre and you live next door, or you're on 1 acre and your neighbor's on 1 acre.
You have a $350,000 home and you have a bunch of vehicles parked lined up next door, something like that. I mean, anyone. Yeah, sightings, noise. It's sometimes covenants to get into renting that type of activity. You can't park a semi truck or whatever. Or if you're going to have, you can't have an RV. Or if you do, it's only during seasonal time.
Yeah, but those are covenants outside.
Yeah,
of,
that's
outside of this.
Yep. I'm just making a comparison.
That's
not. Yeah, at what point do these home businesses start devaluing the neighbor's properties?
That's what we're trying to
do. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's the issue.
Well, and then it gets into the nuisance. You know, maybe it, there's no odor, you know, smell, but if you see it.
Once they get beyond 300 goats.
Sensitive to the site. The one person maybe to another neighborhood is not sensitive.
Remember that hospice in the
Joe, did you say goats?
Well, I don't think we're going to. I think we're raising more questions than we're solving for you. But,
appreciate the input.
Have you compared to other jurisdictions yet?
Internal, and then want to come here and share with you. But we'll do more work and put together some of the, you know, response and comments and everything.
Is there a way we can get a list of just the general, just the different types of home businesses or something, just to get an idea of what's out there?
There's a listing on our website.
Is there?
Okay.
All right.
Isn't
there
the
types of home businesses? Yeah.
There's
well,
a
the ones that we have in our county.
Yeah.
What people are definitely going to weigh in?
Yeah, they're all online now.
Okay.
I can send you a link to put it if you want.
Yeah, do that.
It's a directory.
People might.
Yeah.
I'm just curious.
And they're,
to see,
they're an alphabetical order.
I mean, are these daycares? Because I know that's a
that's a conditional use.
Yeah, that's a conditional use permit.
Is it a different thing?
Yeah.
Salons.
Yeah,
we have
one salon. They also sell wine.
Yeah.
Right.
They also sell what?
It's like a wine distributor and slash salon.
That just says wine.
No, really.
That's
what
you
have a for right now. Glass of wine while you're having your hair done.
Yeah.
Could we get a link to that?
Kathy's gonna need to know where that.
That'd be great. I think that would be helpful.
Wine salon is.
I think that'd be helpful because our most recent example is may not be what's typical. You know, the case we dealt with last month.
However, the business owners have, they have the opportunity to let us know if they want their business listed on the website, and they don't all choose to do that.
Oh, okay.
There's several, though, on there.
But it's all in your permits files, too, if you wanted to go a little deeper.
It is public information.
Sure.
That's requested.
Yeah.
Okay. I think then we'll leave that for now.
That,
yep.
Is that enough?
Okay.
I appreciate your
information. This is our working proposal.
Correct.
Yeah. It's a draft. And so it incorporates existing language,
seeking to
making possible amendments to
kind of take the simplest approach. We know we've got some issues with compliance.
Jerry,
how do we deal with that? How do we deal with businesses, home businesses that are growing, and to transition, you know? So, you know. What else do we exceed as many of the requirements?
I'm trying to figure out a way to take myself down.
Okay.
Thank you.
So, Jerry, the that last paragraph is really the only proposed addition that so far.
Okay.
Yeah.
It would fit into the existing sub 4. So the good part of it would be the enforcement part of it, because that's in there now. We have that option. If they're not in compliance, we can send them a notice of violation. If they don't comply within 30 days, then the ordinance says we're going to send a citation, which ultimately means that we'll go to court to try to judge and make a decision if they do comply. But we don't take that approach.
Okay. Great. Thanks, staff.
Thank you.
Staff comments.
Just to get an idea for the September meeting, we've got quite a few ordinances that we're working on. The access ordinance, transportation impact analysis, Emily's working on that. Home business, possibly you might see that. Cabin RVs, we added language to allow cabins to be in a commercial campground. When we took it to the Board of Supervisors, there was some questions or concern about the time period that would be permitted. Right now, there's like a 30-day limitation during the winter months for occupancy. And so we were asked to look at that and amend the ordinance for that. We realized we kind of just went through a codification of all of our ordinances and realized that in Chapter 90, the conditional use permit section, that an item was inadvertently removed from the ordinance involving dog breeding and dog kennels. So we've got to go through the process, we're told, to get it put back in. So we're going to be bringing that forward. That, again, that was an existing provision that accidentally got removed somehow. So, and then of course, if we have any development cases, we'll be,
there might be a lot of people that are happy about that. Mm-hmm. Not the land, not the business owners, of course.
So that's what we have.
Okay. Commission comments, I would just say I know that we had hoped, probably all of us, that this was going to be a really short meeting tonight. But can I just say that I think discussion items, we got a lot more done on discussion items than it seems like we do, because we can talk freely about it outside the constraints of the normal procedure when we're talking about hearings and we're already penned in by the existing code. So I appreciate your discussion. I appreciate you being patient with it. I think it's important.
Yeah, I think it's a better vehicle for reviewing and discussing than coming forth with, this is a proposal and we're looking for.
Yeah, we want to involve the commission. We don't want to give you a finished product. Here's what we have. You know, we want
you to help us with this, as Aaron said.
And it seemed like, thinking about tonight, are we just all over the place as individuals about this home business, but hopefully it's useful.
It is.
So thank you, commission members, for tonight.
You're welcome.
Are there other comments?
I have one, and I told Stephanie I would discuss it. I got a notice that my term is finishing and asked about whether or not I'm going to continue. And I guess my question is to all of you is... I won't take this personally at all, but whether or not you'd like new blood on, because I think I've been on here the longest. I think I've been
most. You were here when I got here.
Yeah. I think Aaron joined right after or around the same time.
I have the experience on it.
I was just wondering, just for your input. I'm willing to and able to. I just wasn't.
Okay.
But if you thought, maybe, then I'd be. Just as a commission.
I'm more concerned that you want to be here. Then you are contributing now.
No, I will continue to find a way to serve in the community, whether it's here or elsewhere. But
I think it's useful.
We definitely appreciate you being here.
Yeah. All right.
You
enjoy it? No, I do. I do. I enjoy the interaction and I enjoy the participation in the things that we're doing. I which is why I joined the commission, looking for a way to be involved in the community. So that was my.
Well, I think the experience is really in looking at so many issues, and when something comes up, you can remember. That, you know,
well, apparently I missed a big one last month.
Yeah, you did.
But, yeah, so I don't know what I need to. You send an email saying, or am I going to continue or not continue, or I don't know what the process is.
This is fine.
Okay.
And then.
If you're reappointed.
I think it goes to
if you would like to renew, then we usually use an existing application or ask you to fill out a new one.
All right. Let me know if you need it.
Because it does take board of supervisor action.
Okay.
I think we have an existing application for you, so I'll have to look.
All right. Just let me know.
So you've been on here 5 years?
I don't know if I...
Is that an unexpired?
I don't know if I feel an unexpired, but
one moved away.
Yeah.
My 5-year term ends in December.
What are you doing?
So I don't.
Stay on, right?
I've been 5 years, so I don't know if you filled did you fill a non full term and start a second one?
I might have done that. I don't know.
Are there any other commission comments? All right, we have a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Cable? Second?
Second.
No more.
Second.
We are adjourned. Thank you.
Marvin, both of you.